Hello, you're listening to a Zen Studies Society podcast. To learn more about our community of Zen Buddhist practitioners, please visit zenstudies.org.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's so wonderful to see all of you here at this hall session. The beautiful Hoenji. We begin, as our Haudenosaunee neighbors do, with giving thanks. And I want to say thank you, start with people. So thanks, thank you everybody for coming. And we're grateful that everyone was healthy enough to be able to come, and you're able to take care of your obligations, etc., and you're all here, able to participate in session, and you're all giving yourself so generously. And I won't go through the entire Thanksgiving address, but because that would take the whole time. But I do special thanks to our teacher, Shinge Roshi. We are just fortunate beyond words to have such a teacher. Unfortunately, I was not able to attend the recent events at DDC where she was honored, but I understand that was it went very well. And since I wasn't able to go, it made me think, well, I didn't do that. Are there other ways to honor our teacher? What do you guys think?
Yeah.
To express gratitude to our teacher, what might some of those be?
Sit.
Zazen.
Zazen.
Give a talk.
Give a talk.
Be an officer.
Don't run away.
Don't run away. That's very important. Yeah, but there's many ways, but certainly the depth and strength and tenacity of our practice is huge. I think in honoring Murthy and all the teachers that went before her. And speaking of teachers, I want to give a special shout out and thank you to Nikyu sitting over here in the corner. Who has been such an amazing teacher for me, helped me get through my doctorate, and has helped me in so many ways, and is the usual Friday afternoon speaker. So I'm kind of, I know we don't wear shoes in Zen, but kind of big shoes for me. Always gives wonderful talks, so glad you're here. So glad Miyoku. is here, and everybody watching on Zoom, and all of you. Special welcome to the folks from the, when I was in that group, it was called the Student Buddhist Association, but now I guess it's the Buddhist Meditation Association. So it's great to have you here too. And everybody else. So I thought I would start really close to home and say something about how I got to be sitting here. Chikyo and Doshin asked me to be Gyoen for session. So doing Makugyo and some of the other instruments. And I immediately became very anxious and didn't sleep very well. I said yes because it just seemed like the right thing to say. And then a day or two later, Roshi texted me and said, would you like to give a Dharma talk? And so I wasn't so anxious about the going. it's very strange that, you know, how our minds work. But for me, what makes it all possible is all of you here, and Mother Earth, and the trees. In other words, I'm not playing the Makuta. I'm kind of like the pinch hit, the designated hitter. I'm sitting there, but I'm getting support from all of you, from the trees, and it's actually nice to have the shades up so you can see them, from Mother Earth. How often when we're sitting on a cushion do we think, you know, remember that we're sitting not on an inanimate, inert thing, And you may think your cushion's getting really hard, but this is a lie. This is Mother Earth we're sitting on. So take some of that energy. So in other words, and that really helped me hugely with any, because it wasn't about me anymore. It's about all of us and Mother Earth and the sun and all of our teachers and the trees and all of life. So anyway, and that goes also for the instruments that I play. I remember Gisho, some of you remember her, Judy Fancher, who unfortunately passed away at the beginning of COVID in 2020. I remember she was sitting here giving a Dharma talk, and she took the ink and she says, and she hit it a few times. And she talked about inviting the sound of the bell, not just wrapping it. And I can't say I'm always successful, but that's my intention. To me, these are alive. These instruments, they're not dead in our board. They're animate. They're co-producers of the sound. So it's always at least my intention, you may be plugging your ears, but to produce a sound in partnership with the instrument that is conducive to our practice, to what Roshi was talking about yesterday, the deepening presence that we're here for. I've been doing it for quite a long time, but kind of on and off. But certainly long enough to make lots and lots of mistakes. Mistakes aren't bad in this practice. They're how we learn. I made a mistake, pretty big mistake this morning. Does anybody remember what happened this morning? Oh, good, y'all forgot. I totally forgot that I'm supposed to do prostrations, so I kind of ran for the bell, picked it up, and I didn't think the sound was what I was about to do. I just have a lot of notes. I don't know what I'm going to say, but I'm going to say, you know, one of the things about the sound is, I can kind of borrow a phrase from a Haudenosaunee neighbors, is to, or one of the purpose of those words, is to kind of bring us together, to bring our minds together as one. Because I think that's what happens during session, is we become one. So the Shinrei, the alarm bell, brings us together. The Bonsho, which is the one where there's sound and then silence. That's kind of I see that as kind of a transition, like you run on, you sit down, and now a series of almost like dropping water into a pond. And that long silence is, I think, very conducive to coming together. Mm-hmm. And then a kugyo. And the idea of that, of course, is so we all chant as one. So we're all, you know, maybe someone next to you is chanting really loudly and they're offbeat, but you know, the ideal is you want to be listening to one person with the kugyo, and she may be off, but anyway, that's the goal, to bring us together as, that's my goal, as one in chanting and sitting. And so we do things like the walking meditation, the meals, and other practices that help us with that, with bringing our minds together as one. And some of you are new to session, and that's great. We're really happy to have newcomers. Some of you are new to Hōenji, which is also wonderful. It's great to have Ngetsu here. I've worked with her for many years. And BBC forest stuff, so it's wonderful to have you. But just some little things when Ino is pronouncing a dedication. So she's listening, she's calling, she's invoking ancestral teachers We all put our books down. We can leave it on the same page, but we put our books down, we put our palms together. So we're all doing the same thing. And then, you know, there's that question of, what do I do with my sutra book? Like, when I'm chanting, do I just put it back? And there's actually a time when we all together put our sutra books behind us. And that is the last chant, at least the morning service, that we chant will be Shujo, Muhen, Sei, Ganda. We've heard that now several times. We'll do that three times. On the third time, we'll go Shujo, Muhen. And something's happened, like Roshi will get up. Ordained will pick up their bowing mat. Sorry, I don't know what that is. And that's when the rest of us, unless you need your sutra book or shuja movement, we put our sutra books behind us, facing the out, not facing the altar, but at our seat, the part of our seat that's closest to the altar. So again, our minds together as one, we do these practices to kind of help us form that community. So while we're talking about chanting, I want to say it is your excellent karma to be here when we are doing two long of the longer chants, the Lotus Sutra and the Diamond Sutra. And the Lotus Sutra, we actually chanted part of that this morning, and we'll chant the entire thing tomorrow morning. So, and then we'll chant the Diamond Sutra. And there'll be an English translation. We have readers, right? Yes. They don't know who they are, but we have readers. But I thought it might be of interest or use to hear a little bit from the Lotus Sutra. I never go to board meetings. I'm not on the board. But I did go to one because it involved trees. And Roshi always gives opening remarks, and she said something like, it's great to read Emma Chodron and Thich Nhat Hanh and these contemporary teachers who are very accessible, but she challenged us to read the Lotus Sutra, read the Vimalakirti Sutra, read the Rinzai Roku, which Nikki and I are doing together, and it's wonderful. Read some of these other Buddhist texts. And so I kind of took that to heart. And I found that I could listen. You can find readings of the Lotus Sutra, the Vimalakirti Sutra, and some of the other sutras online. So when I was going on long drives, I would listen to the Lotus Sutra or the Vimalakirti Sutra. And I preferred that to reading because these are really oral texts, right? That we listen to. And, you know, my mind would wander, and of course I had to pay attention to the road and all that, but I think it's still useful. So, has anyone read the Lotus Sutra? Okay. Oh, that's a good one. We don't chant the entire thing. We only chant chapter 25. I think there's maybe 30 chapters. And some of you may wonder what we're saying when we chant the Lotus Sutra. We only chant chapter 25, and that is subtitled The Universal Gateway of Kanzayan Bodhisattva, Perceiver of the Sounds of the World. Who is Kanzayan Bodhisattva? Does anybody know? Nobody knows. Yes, yes, yeah. Who hears all cries and responds to all cries. So this is a male gender, but you can substitute female or binary, whatever. But okay, describing them. Suppose someone should conceive a wish to harm you and push you into a great pit of fire. What do you do? Think on the power of Pan's Ion, and a pit of fire will change into a pond. If you should be cast adrift on the vast ocean, menaced by dragons, fish, and demons, think on the power of Pan's Ion, and the billows of waves cannot drown you. Suppose you're on the peak of Mount Sumeru, just hypothetically, and someone pushes you off. And you will hang in midair. Imagine that. You'd be like a hang glider. Suppose you are surrounded by evil-hearted bandits, each brandishing a knife to wound you. And at once, all will be swayed by compassion. Suppose you are imprisoned in chains and locks, hands and feet, bound by fetters. Do you think this has any contemporary relevance? Anybody? Yeah, there's a lot going on in the world. And, without saying a lot, I think this is more relevant than ever. So, I think that's why I said I think we're very fortunate to be able to be chanting this chant, not only once, but twice. So you'll see, when you chant tomorrow, you'll hear Kanveyambosa, and that's Kanveyam. And that will be repeated over and over. So anyway, in case you're wondering what we're chanting.
May I say this to you?
Of course, please.
Okay, traditionally, Kanveyam is the goddess of mercy, and in Japan anyway. So, I went to Kyoto, Sanjusanendo Temple of Kanon, where the thousands of statues of Kan's gold, beautiful, life size of Kanon, Sanzen Kanon standing in that building. And each Kanon has six heads and 12 hands. And each hand carries the So that's what symbolic of if anybody asks for mercy help, Kanzen On will catch it. And I think not only Kanzen On will catch, but the goal to receive that mercy also become reliever of the mercy to others. So it's just, he's not doing by himself. He's just spreading this compassion and the gift for us. So that's it.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you. And on Sunday morning, of course, we will chant Kanzeon for people who are ill or struggling in some way, Sangha members, friends. So, as Agon said, there's a place you can list those names in the order. So, I wanted to say a little bit about where I was last weekend. I was not here. I went up to Canton, near Canton, New York, for a cultivating climate justice event. And this is connected to the Zen Center because the people who invited me are members. So some of you may know Kyoko and Jiko and Yuho, Tal Vandenborg, and there's a few others, but I think they've been coming at least as long as I have. And by coming, I mean they attend our sessions. There's no one here today, but they often attend our sessions, and it's really great to have them here. So they, when I say North Country, they live like Canton, Potsdam area, northern New York. And so get to know them, especially Kyoko over the years. I have a special place in my heart for them because they're really outdoor people. And so anytime I need like help with weeding or tree protection or whatever, they're right there. They've been really helpful for taking care of our grounds and what we have here. And I know Roshi's been up there to be with them at times. I think not recently, but. Anyway, so cultivating climate justice, Tom Porter, who's a Mohawk spiritual leader, chief, spoke on Friday night and Sunday morning. And he was asked on Friday night to give what's called the opening address. And so that is the Haudenosaunee Thanksgiving address, and it actually does not translate as Thanksgiving address. The translation, and I'm sorry, I don't know the Mohawk word, but it's words that come before all else. So before we do anything, we're going to start with gratitude. And not just for, people, or, they go through basically, it's almost like a, what do you call it? An ecosystem inventory. They start with people, and then they go to Mother Earth, and then to water, fish, small plants, food plants, trees, and there's another plant category, I'm forgetting. Birds. It's always a little different. Everybody does it in a little different way. And so anyway, Tom Porter was asked to do this opening. And he didn't really, he kind of did that. He definitely does things his own way, of course, which is great. He picked up this little baby doll that was wrapped in culturally appropriate kind of swaddling. And he said, okay, you folks want to address climate change. I'm going to, I don't know if he said I'm going to show you, but he did. He took this baby and he said, okay, when someone in these Haudenosaunee communities has a child, the women give it a name, and then it is introduced to the creator, and the creator is introduced to the baby. And so he did that. He introduced the creator, created the baby. But he didn't stop there. Next was Mother Earth. He gives the name to the Mother Earth and introducing Mother Earth to the baby. Then it was people, and then it was water, and then it was fish, and then it on and on. Probably took about half hour to go through the whole thing, but I guess what I took away was, addressing climate change at the root is addressing our relationship to land. And I think everybody here knows that. You start with a baby, a newborn, basically. You give that child a name, and you introduce that child to all these entities. And it's not just a nice to do, that's what's keeping us alive, like water, plants, fish, etc. And Tom is not a guy who's going to give us facts about climate change. He was talking about an emotional bond. And that's what I see is missing in a lot of people in terms of our relationship with nature. But of course, it doesn't stop there with the baby. On Sunday, he talked about how when he was 3 years old, he would crawl in bed with his grandmother because, to stay warm in cold weather. And his grandmother would say, you got to get up and start this Thanksgiving process. And he said, oh, no, you do that for me. She said, no, you have to do that. You have to get out of bed. The minute your eyelids open, you're thanking Mother Earth. You're thanking the trees. You're thanking all of these elements that keep us in one. And you do that 3 times a day. How many do that here? Yeah. I actually, when I get up, I'm like, okay, today I have to go. Like, what do I have to do? But honestly, after hearing him, you know, I think, okay, my eyelids open, give thanks. I have another day of life. And look, I mean, homology is just, as Roshi said yesterday, it's just bursting with this incredible beauty. I mean, you just walk along the ramp, and the little pieces of artwork dropped by that silver rainbow, you know, the yellow and green and the splashes of red, it's just, it's stunning. Give thanks for that or acknowledge it. Anyway, and the specificity is important because we're so forgetful. I'm not so forgetful. I mean, how many have given any thought during the session to the fish in Onondaga Creek? One person. I mean, I'm not saying that it's critical, but just to acknowledge there are beings that live in that creek. There are beings that live in the woods. There are beings that live probably in the Zendo, like house centipedes, jumping spiders, etc. And just to acknowledge, there's all these other life forms that we mostly ignore, or we definitely don't give them much room. And this group probably does, but the zoning board, are they going to say, no, we really have to think about the birds and the trees and we have to think about Mother Earth when you consider this development. How often does that happen? We actually thought, so I work at SUNY ESF at the Center for Native Peoples and the Environment, and we have this idea that we're going to give a certificate or a gold star to zoning boards and town municipal governments, I should talk to Fugan about this, who take actions in line with the Onondaga Land Bird exception, in line with the goals of the Thanksgiving address. And now I just want to read, this is a little, I think this might be from 2015, it might be a little dated, but this is the Haudenosaunee Sustainability and Position on Climate Change. Now I'm just going to read a couple of excerpts. The cosmology of the Earth being our mother is a critical part of our consciousness. We urge everyone who hears Mother Earth as a new concept to begin the process to internalize the cosmology into the cultural consciousness of their society. And that's a pretty strong statement. They're saying, your leaders, your political leaders, your educators, you've got to start acknowledging Mother Earth. Religious organizations, the spiritual consciousness of the world community needs to express thanksgiving for all of creation, beginning with our Mother Earth at every gathering, as a humble expression of our dependence on creation. And we know that. Jonathan Tom said, he pointed out that if the humans were to die off, everything would be fine, not for the most part, except some of the agricultural plants and maybe a few other things. But if we were to lose, say the fungi, we'd be in trouble, right? So he did that on Friday night, and then Saturday morning we had something very different, but related. This is more related to climate change. Again, it wasn't technical, this was a professor, an author named Timothy Beale, and he wrote this book, When Time's Short, and I just got it, so I haven't read it yet. But his thesis is that it's too late. We've passed too many tipping points. We're going to get to that 1.5 degree C, probably, unless we plant an awful lot of trees. And so now we're sort of in this palliative care stage, which is not very hopeful, I guess, but to me, it really wasn't about human extinction so much. It was about who we are as a species and the idea that we are not any different from any other animal or any other species. We talked a lot about human exceptionalism, and there's the zoning board for it, right? And it just permeates our system that we think that belongs to us and we can do what we want, pretty much. It's just property. So he really challenged that, and I won't go into it, but he's a Hebrew Bible scholar, and so he went back into some of the early passages in Genesis that talk about subduing the earth, and I forget some of the other ones, but that are particularly, I guess, pernicious in terms of giving permission for, to move forward with a capitalist agenda. And he said, no, this was mistranslated. This was not what the ancient Hebrew people said. Like they would have never thought about dominion over the earth because life was hard, lifespans were short. You know, at the most, maybe dominion over your domestic livestock, but this would have been unthinkable to people, the Hebrew shepherds, et cetera, back in the day. Anyway, but that was interesting. But, you know, it's 400 years too late. Mistranslation has happened. And whether, you know, to me, extinction is, of course, it's something to be concerned about. But I really liked David Lori's approach when he was here. Was anyone here for his talks? David Lori, maybe you've read some of his books. You guys, anybody know David Lori? He's a Buddhist scholar who also has written quite a bit about climate change. And like I would say, he's probably the leading Buddhist writer on climate change. His position is, you know, we're not all that concerned with outcome. As Buddhists, we're concerned with outcome. We're not attached to outcome. We do things because they're the right thing to do. So his model is let's focus on the six paramitas and use those as a way, it's kind of a guide to responding to climate change and responding to the environmental issues of our time in general, right? Because we're losing bats, we're losing birds, we're losing insects. I mean, you know, we could go on and on. Anyway, what else did I want to say? Yeah, he says the insight and equanimity that we're cultivating right here at Session support what is most distinctive about Buddhist activism, acting without attachment to the results of our action, something that is easily misunderstood as kind of a casual attitude. Instead, our task is to do the very best we can, not knowing what the consequences will be. Not knowing if our efforts will make any difference whatsoever. We don't know if what we do is important, but we do know that it's important for us to do it. Have we already passed the ecological tipping points and civilization as we know it is doomed, as this guy says? We don't know. But it's not that important. We hope our efforts will bear fruit. But ultimately, they are our gift to Mother Earth. And The only other things Tom Porter says, I have to say, because, you know, the message or the litany of issues in the world could be totally depressing. I mean, now we've got this outbreak of violence in the Middle East, on top of all the other issues. But, and of course, we need to take those seriously. But I want to return to something Tom Porter said. He said, you know, the Creator wants to see the whites of your teeth 3 times a day. In other words, he's talking about smiling. And the indigenous people I know have this incredible sense of humor. He said, don't go around with your lower lip dragging on the ground. So, and you know, here at Session, we may think this is very serious. We don't make eye contact. We don't really smile at each other. But I think there is an element of joy in what we do, and the things we're able to observe, like the tree I mentioned, and just being here together with each other, just being able to sit together with our teacher and Sandra, elders and friends is cause for joy, I think, as well as eating these incredible meals, education that I mean, Robert is, so. So I think that's important to not completely lose track of. Kind of jumping around here, but the second long chant that we will do, like I said, is the Dhamma Sutra. And I don't know how many of you have seen this book by Thich Nhat Hanh. It's called Zen and the Art of Saving the Planet. Now, I really don't like, I mean, saving the planet. That seems more than I can do. But it's kind of his guidance on how to be a Buddhist activist for the Earth in particular. And he says that he calls the Dhamma Sutra the world's first treatise on deep ecology and a treasure of humanity's shared wisdom heritage. And for those of you who don't know it, what you'll hear tomorrow is in the Dhamma Sutra, the meditator is urged to throw away, to release foreign notions in order to understand our own true nature and the nature of reality. The notion of self, the notion of human being, the notion of living beings, and the notion of lifespan. So you'll hear over and over something like, if someone retains the notion of a separated individuality, personality, a being or a name, that person is not a bodhisattva. And Thich Nhat Hanh divides these into these four notions. And I think it gets back to a little bit to what I was saying about, well, you know, I'm not giving this talk, you know, I'm not giving the food down necessarily, but it's bigger than me. In the sutra, it says that if you are still caught in these notions, you are not yet free. You cannot be a real bodhisattva and awakened being, helping to relieve suffering in the world. But if you can break through the ideas, you'll have insight, understanding, and freedom you need to help save the planet. And I would say that most of us, at least myself, I'm still caught in these notions, but that doesn't stop me from doing what I can for Mother Earth. There's no more thing I want to do here. There's a little section called Seeing and Acting in the Light of the Diamond Sutra. The Diamond Sutra helps us to touch the deep realization that we are intimately bound to the web of life, which I think is also what the Haudenosaunee are what they're cultivating with their Thanksgiving dress. With the insight of interbeing, we realize we're never alone, we're never powerless, and everything we will ever do counts. This is a real source of comfort. The Diamond Sutra invites us to throw away the idea that we're separate from our family, friends, and colleagues, and to throw away the idea that we're separate from the planet. These teachings invite us to experience a very tangible interbeing right in this very moment, and touch a sense of identity that is far vaster than we usually allow. And I think this is important too. The author, this is not Tinker Hans, this is one of the students. She says, in Plum Village, after teaching the Diamond Sutra, Tay would lead us on a walking meditation outside. We'd walk out along muddy paths through the oak forest to admire the view across the rolling French countryside. Sometimes an old church bell would echo newly across the valley, and we'd all take a few minutes to stop and breathe with the land, with our ancestors, and with whatever we're carrying in our heart. The present moment and eternity happen at the same time. So maybe tomorrow after the Diamond Sutra, Jiki Jitsu will take us outside. I guess the last thing I wanted to say was I think this has to do with intervening. I'm jumping around a little bit, but back to Canton. On Saturday night, after we listened to the Bible Scholar, and I spoke also, I spoke on landscaping the native plants, and actually I had a lot of pictures from the Zen Center and what we're doing here. Then I got to have dinner with Chico and her husband, and Kyoko and her husband, and I thought I stayed at their house, and Yuho, and one. And it was just so nice to sort of be in their world, because they've come here so many times. And so, you know, I really felt, I guess, the treasure of fandom, and how we're not just like right here in Syracuse, and we know that. But to go there and experience it was really wonderful. And I got to spend some time with each of them. Yuho, so the presentations were all day on Saturday, and I gave mine Saturday morning. And he came up to me, and I'm sitting in his pew because it was in the church, and he said, "My rocks are." I missed some of the presentations in the afternoon, but he took me on a walk near his property, which is near Kyoko's, and it was just delightful to be out with him because we share a lot of forests and trees and you know, exploring and learning the names of things. And what plant is that? So that was really delightful. So just special thanks to our North Country friends, some of whom they've got Zoom. I think that's all I know. Thank you for listening.
This has been a Zen Study Society podcast. If you found it to be of interest, please consider making a donation by visiting zenstudies.org/donate. Thank you for listening.